get to an end point. And so I'm feeling okay because I trust the process.
Very good. Very good. So thanks for agreeing to speak with me. You know, I'm writing up this piece. I don't have any plan yet on what to do with it other than share it with friends and folks that might be interested. But, you know, the focus is on the relationship between rent control and incorporation. And I thought you would, I'm sure you would have a lot to offer on that. So,
well, I have some, you know, the primary, I think resource around that would be Ruben, maybe Carlos, but definitely Ruben, yeah, and William, probably. And I'm certain you're talking to them. But yeah, I have some thoughts. I can show you how, since I was, in today's language, the campaign manager or lead organizer for the incorporation movement, I can tell you how it fit in. And I wasn't a renter, so I can tell you how it got blended into the overall effort around incorporation and became a priority. Yeah, I can talk about that.
That'd be great.
Now, the story is pretty straightforward. So why don't we get to your questions? And you can ask them as you wrote them, or you can do it any way you wish.
Well, yeah, I guess the only question I added was a initial one, just when did issues such as rent control and just cause eviction first come on your radar screen?
In the incorporation movement?
Yeah.
I wasn't a renter.
And so as you thought about the relationship between incorporation and rent control and the politics of it, it's particularly what I'm interested in, you know, how did you see it?
You know, I'm looking back. I don't know if I had a proactive strategic analysis at that point. But the main opposition to incorporation and its principal financiers was the absentee landlords. And yeah, so that group became a natural enemy to incorporation. And even though I wasn't a renter, then seeing a natural ally as renters, you know, for me and the role that I was playing became, that was just reasonable, and it resulted in part from, you know, how the politics of incorporation happened. And then once we did the outreach to the West Side and rent control became the primary interest of people on the West Side. I mean, safety, public safety, I think, was everybody's first issue, maybe. I don't want to overstate the case, but right up there near the top of the list, maybe at the top for the group of activists who were involved in corporation was rent control. And so the fact that our primary opposition was absentee landlords and our allies were very interested and strongly concerned about rent control. And in terms of the African-American community, this was the Black Power era. And so the notion of giving voice, legitimacy, to community and enacting policy that benefited community and not the corporate sector was a natural I was able to come to that conclusion easily as a Black activist who was engaged in the Black Power movement, as someone who was working on incorporation, and the principal enemy was the absentee landlords. And our way to get to the West Side, I mean, my organizing strategy has always been find somebody that's affiliated with an identity group and let them be your connector. And so we needed to organize in the West Side. There were connectors, in this case, Ruben, eventually Carlos. And those connectors' primary issue was rent control. So all of those three things for me came together in that way around the connection between rent control. And so the reason that it was high priority. So when we set the first agenda, we probably couldn't take an action on creating our own police force then. But one of the big issues was creating our own police force. That took a while, almost a year, but that was a high priority issue. But Berkeley and then the Southern California city, I forgot what it was. Those were the first two, huh?
Santa Monica, maybe?
Yeah, Santa Monica. And then we took Berkeley's rent control ordinance and passed it essentially verbatim and became the third city in the state with rent control.
Yeah, so that West Side part, you know, it's interesting to me because that was the center of gravity for the East Palo Alto Council of Tenants. And
right.
I was involved in, and that's where we did a lot of voter registration and leafleting. We did a lot of, we did workshops and meetings in homes and things like that. But I also remember LAFCO. So even, when you had those two votes on incorporation, and in the first vote, part of the West Side was not included. And then the second vote, they did include all of the
West. No, it was different. No, absolutely not. So the first vote, all of East Palo Alto was included. But the East, the Menlo Park Sanitation District also served Menlo Park residents.
Right.
And so Menlo Park residents, by virtue of being in that district, got to vote on our incorporation because the LAFCO ruling was that we had to dissolve five districts and incorporate the city in the vote. So there were five measures on the dissolve four districts and then vote for the incorporation. All five measures passed in East Palo Alto. It was the vote to dissolve the Menlo Park Sanitation District and the voters in Menlo Park that defeated incorporation in the first vote.
Right.
The second vote, there was only one thing on the ballot, and that was, do you want to incorporate, yes or no?
Right. But the LAFCO did get pressure from the landlords wanted to be left out. They wanted the West Side left out so they could, because they were arguing to integrate with Menlo Park. They wanted Menlo Park to annex, right?
Well, no, LAFCO as a body, at least at LAFCO staff, strongly opposed the incorporation. And the majority of the LAFCO body opposed it too. So let me just tell you how it all happened. And this is not directly related to rent control. So the LAFCO staff strongly opposed incorporation. They hired a consultant that did the technical study that's required, and their consultant concluded that incorporation was not feasible for the unincorporated area of East Palo Alto. We hired our own consultant who was on the staff of the Stanford Research Institute, right there in Menlo Park, and our consultant concluded strongly that incorporation was feasible. And because of the stature of the Stanford Research Institute, vis-a-vis the stature of the consultant that they hired, the LAFCO itself had to favor or approve our first request before the first vote. The instincts of the LAFCO majority was to oppose the incorporation vote. But because of the Stanford Research International study, they really couldn't oppose the vote, but they created five measures, one of which included voting by Menlo Park residents on our incorporation. So a couple things happened. After that first vote failed, we got lucky. KCBS, this was before, social media, but KCBS for several months ran daily an editorial about how unfair it was for East Palo Alto to not be incorporated because Menlo Park residents had voted it down. And they kept hammering and hammering and hammering that there should be a second vote and that Menlo Park residents shouldn't be allowed to vote. Of course, we were doing our own politics, and there were friends of East Palo Alto who were also doing politicking, but the combination of that came together. And the LAFCO then approved a second vote with the only the one measure, without the requirement that the four districts be dissolved. And so, yeah, that's how all that politic played out. And that's not directly related to the rent control. I mean, the rent control piece I've already talked about. But that's how those two elections played out.
So did you have any concern or concerns voiced to you by other folks on whether supporting rent control might alienate some of the homeowners in the community?
No, that was the main there were two groups that opposed I'm not sure if I came out of your screen. Can we launch it again?
You're still there.
I see. Okay. All right. I'm back. So there were two groups that opposed incorporation. The Homeowners Association, and their primary argument was that if we incorporate, you will lose your home. Yes. And the other group, major group that opposed it, was the absentee landlords.
Yeah. So did you anticipate that the opposition from the landlords would remain, would be quite so extensive? I mean, I have a lot of evidence on how they went to a 3-county area, and basically every landlord in that tri-area county area gave money to a fund to fight against.
No, that was my first real big organizing effort. Looking back, I can understand it, but in the moment, I wasn't aware and conscious and strategic, you know, about how to deal with this. We just did grassroots organizing and we won. We knew that was a formidable, I mean, in the course of the work, we knew that they were a formidable force, that they had lots of resources. And so let me just give you a couple other examples.
Yeah.
So Pete McCloskey became the attorney for the opposition. And so Pete McCloskey, because he had just come out of the Congress, he was still connected to all the governmental agencies. Those of us who were in the leadership of the incorporation movement, we got investigated by the FBI. The reason that I know, and our phones got tapped, the reason that I know this is that I had been a deputy superintendent in the Ravenswood City School District, and an employee who was there, who was after I left the school district, who was a senior staff member in the school district, called me and said that he had been visited by the FBI, who was doing an investigation about my role in the incorporation. So I got firsthand from a person who got visited by the, I didn't even know what was going on. And then when it went to trial court, Pleat McCoskey tried to introduce all that evidence and the trial judge wouldn't hear it. We were aware in the moment, or as the moment evolved, we were aware that the politics of this, the LAFCO staff and the majority of the board opposed us at the county. Pete McCloskey was bringing to bear all of his connections and resources to oppose the incorporation. The absentee landlords and their wealth and their networks, I didn't know specifically where the money was coming from, but their networks were opposing the incorporation. And so yeah, we were aware in the moment that all of this opposition existed, yes.
So, and I want to get back to that point, but just on a more specific, do you think that the FBI became interested because McCloskey?
That's always been my speculation, yes.
So you're right.
I don't have any, that's my speculation, yes.
Yeah. So you just summarized it really well, that all these forces against the community.
And then internally there was the Homeowners Association. So those are all the forces, yes.
Right. And they use lawsuits, they use recall elections, they use initiatives, et cetera. But what I think is so fascinating about this case is that you guys beat them down every single time. Every single time. Well,
there's a reason we did that. On the front side. The reason, there were probably three reasons that we did that. Maybe four. When we formed the incorporation committee, we agreed that we would only work on incorporation, even though there were lots of community issues. And so the laser focus concentration of the committee itself just on incorporation was one of the most significant factors. Secondly, that SRI study is what got us through the LAFCO to the Board of Supervisors. Because once it got to the Board of Supervisors, their only task with a positive LAFCO recommendation was to schedule an election. Thirdly, we had a superior Supreme lawyer, Tom Adams, who was a law, you know, at the time, the environmentalists had a lot of power in San Mateo County. The lawyer for the environmental community in San Mateo County, one of them, and one of the chief ones, was a guy by the name of Tom Adams. Tom Adams became our lawyer. So he hobnobbed with all these people at the county all the time. So he represented us. And so that was the other factor. And then finally, as we got to the, as I said, into the second vote, the popular opinion became that we had been unfairly treated in the election. And KCBS, again, this is my own speculation, I think they played a really, really big role in getting the second election to happen.
As the landlords, you know, even after the election, kept on fighting, was there any talk, ever any, you know, consideration given to, hey, maybe we should just repeal this rent control law and let them win?
Oh, no, not. I was on the council for the first city council. I think I was on the council 2 years. I'm not aware of any, and I had a pretty prominent role on the first city council. That was never an issue that came up, never.
Yeah. Okay. Wow, this has been really interesting.
No, we were, we're in the midst of the Black Power movement. And so we weren't going to capitulate to some landlords.
Right. Yeah.
At the time, East Palo Alto's 2/3 Black. And so, and it's basically a Black movement to incorporate East Palo Alto. And so we weren't going to capitulate to some white absentee landlords, not at all, no.
Yeah. Looking back, do you think that rent control has been a net positive for the community or not?
The answer is yes. I think that eventually, as you know, the landlords took the matter to the state legislature, and the state legislature began enacting laws that gutted the local ordinances in Berkeley, San Mateo, Santa Monica, and East Palo Alto. Gutted may overstate the case, but set limitations and boundaries around local rent control ordinances.
Do you think that the immediate precipitating factor was the East Palo Alto and the worry that that model might spread through the state?
I have no idea, but I doubt it. Okay. I think my guess is that the association that absentee landlords belong to, whatever the apartment associations were, this was a natural issue for them to keep legislative watch around, to track, and wherever an incorporation raises head with the possibility of rent control, they would show up in force. I would think that would be a natural, but I didn't have any connections with them, and so I don't want to speculate in terms of the fact of it. But I would imagine that would be a natural area of focus for their professional or association, their groups.
I learned that a year ago, the California adopted statewide rent control.
But again, all of the statewide legislation was less restrictive than the local ordinances.
Yeah,
that had happened. The progressive ordinances that had been enacted in local jurisdictions, and so there still is rent control, if you follow what I'm saying, but it doesn't have the same teeth that the local ordinances had.
So, this is moving away. But if you have a few more minutes, I'm just can't resist asking you, how do you compare the political climate today to that of the late 60s, early 70s, when you were getting involved in politics?
I've actually answered that question. So when I think about the late 60s, I think about mass movement. And so there were lots of big gatherings. marches, protests that eventually caught the attention of the national media. And when this organizing and protests became the daily stories on the national media, that was then what I think was really central to what the changes that occurred at the national level. And so precipitated by the assassination of first Kennedy and then later Martin Luther King. Bobby Kennedy is somewhat, but much less so in terms of the impact. And so this is just impressionistic, but there was mass movement, and the target was primarily government, and it played out less at the, since I wasn't in the South, it played out less for me at the state level, whereas it was playing out that way in a lot of Southern states. I was seeing it play out as a national movement. I was thinking about it nationally. And so today I think is just the reverse. It's kind of like a let a thousand flowers bloom. Everywhere you go, there's somebody organizing, trying to do something in their own little space to get it done in their own way. And the problem today, if there is a problem, I think if problem is not the best word, but the challenge today is how do you connect those voices and those efforts and lift them up so that they have a transcending effect across the country. Now, if you had asked me this question before Black Lives Matter, that's how I would have answered it. So what's going on today is much more embedded across the country in ways that are having better impact because it's happening from the local level up. And it's not the daily story in the national media, but this work is going on everywhere. And it's not just in people of color communities. There are partnerships. There's a multi-sector, multiracial partnerships that's making this happen. And you can, everywhere you go, somebody's organizing, doing something. It's just that it wasn't connected across sectors and at the national level. And then all along comes Black Lives Matter. That was the most profound thing that I've seen in my life regarding the organizing. And what often has happened in the past is that there's a moment of opportunity. And sometimes the principal organizers are not prepared to translate the opportunity into policy action. And I'm not being critical. You don't have a crystal ball. You don't know. They didn't know that the whole world was going to protest. And the fact that the protest was occurring in so many places has to be attributed to the fact that they had actually done a lot of great organizing. So you had lots of points of sparking of those protests around the country, which but then happened internationally. So since you don't have the infrastructure and the means to translate your protest, even if it's mass, into action, then the other side changes the narrative. And so they say, no, defund the police, and they elect Republicans.
And then you get the different roles between, you know, politicians and activists.
So all of that plays out. Yeah. But the act of the Black Lives Movement, period, it was the most profound thing I've seen.
Yeah, what really gave me hope was also...
Let me make one other point. And so all of that individual grassroots organizing is still going on. It just got inspired in another way by the Black Lives Movement and seeing the mass international protests around those issues, around justice issues.
Yeah, I think the multiracial aspect of the protest was striking and hopeful. So, you know, one of the things that's been on my mind is that you have certain degree of activism and protest and social movement going on that's deeply embedded in communities and in issues that's long term. It's going to persist no matter who's in president, right? But then it seems to me you also have some aspects of what's been going on the last few years that is a reaction to Donald Trump being in office and the things he's doing.
I didn't mention that, but of course that is a significant piece.
When Joe Biden becomes president, you know, it'll be interesting to me to see how much of it drops off, right?
So what you have is a parallel. Donald Trump, in my view, is going to try to set up a parallel government. I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't create a cabinet in the various government, in the same categories where you have governmental agencies, and challenge policy all over the country in the way that he's challenging the election now, and he may have the juice to do that. I agree with what you're saying. I just think going forward, there will be this, it's kind of like what happened with incorporation. You had two opposing sides, and in both cases, the first vote and the second vote, it was less than 30 votes in terms of whoever, the victory. So the country is divided right down the middle, and it took us 10 years to actually emerge from that level, that kind of division, and we're a local community. And so I just imagine that the division is going to be the predominant thing that we see, variable factor that we see. And it'll play out in multiple ways. And if the Republicans remain control of the Senate, I think that anytime you have leadership that's been in place a long time, and the Democrats had the losses that they had in the last election, that leadership needs to move on. I mean, and so that's not happening. And so that's a problem, I think, in the Democratic Party. I think that, the duality of the opposition and division within the country is going to be the dominant theme through the rest of this decade.
Yeah. Well, you know.
And I was about to say, if the Republicans get the Senate, this time there will be no motion. And if the Democrats get the Senate, I hope they won't do what Obama did. So Obama negotiated. And then, for example, when Obamacare came up for vote, they negotiated it down, watered it down, then not one Republican voted for it. And so I just hope Biden, if he has a majority in this Senate, takes bold action. But who knows? He might say, well, I want to get along with the other side and their opposition. So who knows? We'll see. But I think the political dynamic in the country for at least the next decade will be the division.
Well, you remember the 80s and 90s were a period when, you know, the difference between the parties weren't that huge, and the U.S. seemed sort of stuck in a certain centrist groove. But now we're in a period where you could imagine it going all the way to fascism. You could imagine, you know, historic progressive change or anything in between. No,
but the difference is this. This is the difference. That's true, but this difference is this. So when you look on the Republican, or let's say the conservative side, the moderate conservatives don't dominate the party. Right. The grassroots activists do. On the Democratic side, the grassroots activists don't dominate the party. The moderates do.
Exactly. That's a good way of putting it.
The moderates on the Democratic side attack the activists on the Democratic side as much as those on the Republican side. It's a crazy phenomenon, but that's what I see.
Do you think activists on the left and right steal ideas from each other, tactics?
I think organizing, there are 10,000 ways to organize, but fundamentally, yeah, it's messaging and connecting and bringing people out to lift up their voice. So I don't know that they study each other, but I think that you would find some parallelism in the tactics, yes, I'd imagine. And by the way, we're in an era of social media, and I'm an OG, so I don't really know social media and its applications. And my response to this question is pre-social media, yeah.
Right, good. Well, that's really all I have. I'm going to try to get in touch with some other folks like Lon and Ruben.
Yolanda, Diane, Mike, if you talk to Diane, they were also very active in that work. But yeah, Ruben was with regards to the nexus to rent control, he was the main person.
Yeah, were leaders, and Lon and I.
And I don't remember William being actively involved in the incorporation committee, but later on he became the chief spokesman for that work.
Yeah, he came around after I left, but I met with him for a couple out in East Palo Alto a couple of years ago. We had a nice talk. He's an interesting character.
Yeah, no, he's got lots and lots of information. Yeah, he does, and he's a talker. Anyway, I've got to run. Anything else?
Well, just if I write up something 15, 20 pages,
I'll look at it. Give you any feedback, just for factual check.
If there's any ideas about how to use it, how to share it best, I appreciate that.
No, it's all good. You and Rob Lowe are the only ones I know that have given brought an academic eye over time to East Palo Alto. So I don't know if you're connected with him.
Yeah, I talked to Bob. I tried to get him involved in this writing project, and he said he would be happy to look over drafts, but he couldn't commit to being a co-author. So
yeah, no, not a problem. So anything that you have, I don't hardly ever say no. So you can just anticipate that for me, it's not if, it's just when.
All right.
So if you have a request, I'll probably do it.
Thanks, Emmanuel. I appreciate
it. It's always a pleasure. It's really good to reconnect. You have a good one, okay?
Yeah.
Take care. Bye-bye.